Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Faces of RFR. This is where we get the opportunity to kind of learn a little bit about various recovering from religion volunteers. And today, we've got a fantastic person, a fantastic volunteer we're going to get to interview. I'm really, really excited. Hey, Chris, welcome.
Hi, Eric. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Hey, you know, you've got a fantastic head of hair there. I love it. You're just like a cool-looking dude. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm coping with this head of hair. In my family, there's no baldness, but premature gray.
Yeah, that's so, kind of, I've got something similar too. You can see I've got quite a bit of gray. I think my father went salt and pepper around the age of 35 or so.
Yeah, that's about the age it sort of hits all of my family. What I don't understand, and it seems not the case with you, is if we have a mustache, it turns ginger.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. All of the gray that you see, that used to be red hair for me. Yeah.
Might be a black hair thing. I don't know.
Well, Chris, I'm just given your first name. What's your full name and where are you located? Because you have a different sort of accent than I do.
I've got a different kind of accent to a lot of people, I think. I'm Chris Boothman, and I live in a very sleepy village in the middle of Somerset in England. But the accent is weird because both parents are actually from Lancashire, which is northern England. And so if I spend too much time talking with them, my accent changes. It suits whoever I'm talking to in a funny kind of way. If I talk to a Londoner, I almost become a Cockney. And if I talk to some friends in this area, that you start to get that rural drawl. And that's no good either. So whatever. The worst of all cases.
Sort of like here in the US, we have like a much larger country, but it doesn't seem like we have as many accents as the UK seems to have.
And also in such a short area. I mean, I can go from here 30 miles and it's a different accent.
Wow.
It is very strange. There's a guy, you heard of Tony Hancock? He's an old, he's dead now, but he's an old English comedian. And he actually became famous by imitating an on-screen pirate. So he actually got famous by doing the ooh and all this sort of stuff. And little worrying.
Well, so you are a volunteer for Recovering from Religion. What program do you volunteer for?
Well, I actually started as a helpline volunteer. But Bill and Brian, who are creators of the resources team, asked for volunteers who would be willing to help with them. And so I put my hand up and joined that as well. So I'm now also a curator of the resources. We've just recently taken on somebody else. And one of our teamers has retired. Very long period of time.
Do you still work on the helpline? Do you take chats or phone calls or anything?
Absolutely. It was doing that was the reason for me joining or wanting to join. That's not to say that I had the right idea of what it was going to be like when I joined. I think a lot of people join because they're big fans of the atheist experience. And so they think to themselves, well, hang on, this is a place where I can go and have arguments with Christians all the time.
Oh.
And that's what I envisaged. And then I did the training and realized it was not going to be anything like that at all, but that I still liked the idea.
Yeah.
Because the purpose for me, you know, yes, I do like a good argument, but there has to be a purpose to it. And the purpose was always to benefit that person, not, you know, just for the sake of an argument. And what I realized with the training was that that's what it actually did. The doing it the way the training suggests is the best way of benefiting the clients. And at the end of the day, that's the purpose of RFR. And so I love doing it. I don't do it as much as I would like, and it's something I am very keen on keeping up. It's one of the things when I joined the resources team, I said I'm very happy to do the resources, but I don't want it to be at the cost of me spending time doing
Yeah.
chats and things. And as you know, we're doing another project as well on a slightly different scheme. And again, part of that, and part of the message we have to all of the volunteers who help us with that, is the aim is not to take you away from why you joined, which is the chat and the calls.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so, it sounds like you really, really enjoy kind of taking the chats, and obviously it's not a place for debate or anything, but what do you get out of doing some of the chats?
I think by nature I am a problem solver, and I think when you start the chats and the calls, people are calling in with a problem. Now that problem might be a question in their head, it might be an emotional issue, and I may well not have the answer. And I think that's probably the most important thing for a helpline volunteer to learn, is that the chances are you haven't got the answer. But your job is to provide the means by which they can find it. Now, that might be by looking through our resources. It might be through support groups. It might be through looking through Reddit and finding information there. There are a number of things we can put forward. It might be secular therapy. And that's a useful one that I've put forward a lot. Therapy has helped me in my life, and it's something that I'm very happy to promote. So it's that role of almost being a kind of, I've likened it in a nice way, I like to think, to being a doctor's receptionist, in that somebody comes in with a problem, and the receptionist has a chat with you, gets to know what the problem is, and directs you to the right person.
I like that.
So that's kind of the way I look at it. You know, the doctor's, the receptionist job is not to cure you. It's to make sure you get the right information and the right help. So that's what I like about it.
I like that. I've never heard that metaphor before, and I really kind of like that. So you're also a part of the resources team, and we have got the Recovery from Religion has got so many resources. Like it's just incredible what they've collected and are able to provide for folks who are just questioning or doubting. What kind of part do you play in the resources program?
Well, this is going to sound strange, but Brian, who's the curator, who's become curator emeritus, will love me for saying this. The biggest job is what we don't put in,
Oh, yeah.
and this is the hardest job, because on the first look, and we do get inundated with potential resources, people making suggestions. And our role as curators is first and foremost to ensure that the resources stick to the ethos of RFR, in that we are not providing resources to help people argue against religion. We're providing resources to help people understand how they see their issues with religion, how other people have dealt with their issues in religion. And it's very much ensuring that our resources meet that criteria is probably the hardest part, but again, the most enjoyable part.
This sounds like a pretty tricky line to walk sometimes, because you know, recovering from religion is not about deconverting folks. We're really meeting them where they're at. So, yeah, I had not actually considered that the hard work that the resources team would have to put in to keep it, not keep it from trending towards deconverting or something like that.
Yeah. The other thing is when you look at it, and in a way, this is what led to the RFR3 project. I first looked at the resources as part of the training and thought, if every volunteer who wants to become a helpline volunteer has to know these resources, they're going to fail. It's almost setting yourself up to fail. And the nature of how they were available to us was a big issue. They are on page after page after page, barely searchable, and finding any particular resource, even if you've got an inkling of what you're looking for, was not easy. And the existing curators, Bill in particular, was very keen on computerizing the resources. And in a way that played into my history, my experience. And so I was able to show them that this could be done, how it could be done, and the benefits of doing it. And so that's really what led to first talking about RFR 3.0.
Yes, and that's a project that's really pretty big and expansive, and is going to affect every program within Recovering from Religion. And you're the one who's kind of spearheaded this project and brought your skills to bear to give some proof of concepts. And it's going to make not only the volunteers' work easier, but also I can see clearly that it's going to make the folks who visit the Recovering from Religion website be able to find what they need much easier too.
Very much so. In the work that I did in business, funnily enough, whatever kind of position you are in IT, you end up dealing with the highest parts of the organization because of management information. And it's that, it's the flow of information through any organization that benefits the management the most. And in a way, and I'm not decrying how things are without RFR 3.0, because it's grown exponentially in the way things grow from an IT perspective. And every now and again, you have to kind of draw a line and say, we can't keep going with just expanding without an ideal or a principle to follow.
Right.
By looking at this and by coming out with the RFR 3.0 idea, it meant that we could look at it from a management information perspective. And through, as you know, talks with yourself and with Todd, who's the helpline director, so much work is being done by yourselves to get management information together that could be automated, that should be automated. But the way things were, it couldn't be done. And so this new system is very much based on ensuring that this management information is being provided very easily, very readily available. And that's going to allow us to provide a much better service. As you know, one of the things that you and I were talking about, it's very hard for you to know where is the next best area to create a new support group. And only management information can find that. exactly, and only recording all of the inquiries and being able to interrogate them. Can we find that information out easily? And so that's really been the crux behind it. The easy and understandable flow of information is one thing, and the improvement that it makes to manage information.
Yeah. So it sounds like you know what you're talking about when it comes to this type of database building and kind of new interface type of building. Tell us a little bit about your background. Like, how did you get to be able to, how did you learn how to do this, and what did you do for a living?
This all started because my parents could only afford one game, and that's the truth of it. When I was 11, they bought me a ZX Spectrum.
Now, oh,
I don't know if you're one of the people who know what a ZX Spectrum is.
Yeah,
but it was about this big, and the keys were rubber. And I got this for my 11th birthday with like I say, one game, and it was an adventure game. And in a month, I'd done it, you know, as I think everybody had. And then what do? This thing sat on your table. There's no games. So I started looking at it, and I knew that if I pressed a button, it came up with list. And I thought, why does pressing that button make it come up with list? What's that about? Pressing another button, it would come up with print. And I started looking into it, and I realized that you could program with this poxy little computer. And that became a much more enjoyable game, because I would think, can I make it do this? And then I would have a go, and I would make it do that. An example I give, if you can cope with this, is and it's a way that shows it how IT starts to move you into other fields of information, because I have no IT knowledge at all, and I decided I want to draw a circle. Mm-hmm. So I found an old book of my dad's that had the equations for circles. Sokotoa, we call it. Sine equals opposite of hypotenuse, etc., etc., etc. And it showed me how I could work out, with a given radius, where a point would have to go on the edge of the circle. And so if I had a number going from 0 to 360 for 360 degrees of the circle, strictly speaking, 359, I could calculate where a dot would have to go to draw this circle.
Right.
And so it took me about 3 weeks, and I remember pressing run and watching it, thinking, I've drawn a circle, the world is good, I am a genius. And then I was flicking through the manual, and it said, circle command. So this is probably one of the most important lessons I ever learned.
Read the manual. I did a little programming on the TI-81 calculators when they came out. Some basic programming on MS-DOS and stuff like that. And, you know, I kind of did enjoy learning how to do, learning alternate ways to do something instead of just using a simple command. Yeah, the simple command was there, but I also really enjoyed and I learned a lot by trying to figure out how to do the same thing in a different way.
Well, this is the other thing. I mean, I did go on then to take O-level computer science and A-level computer science and learn the proper way of doing many things. What was the most enjoyable thing about learning about computer science was you got to learn the history and you got to learn how it all got started. I don't know if you know this, but the moment you open up a computer and start looking inside and looking at the names of things and how things work, they were created by a complete bunch of hippies.
Yeah.
They really were. I mean, the data travels on a bus. How hippie is that? I'm amazed they didn't actually make sure and say that they had to paint flowers on the side of the cables or something. when a external device wants anything, it raises a flag, you know, and then you have to handshake. And it's just, you know, it's all hippie. It really is.
So what do you do for a living these days?
Well, I was very lucky. I got divorced. No, that's not.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you know, that is
good. Lucky I'm lucky that.
But I got divorced and I was running a fairly successful IT company, it kind of gave me an opportunity to reevaluate things, and there were opportunities abroad that interested me, and so I basically sold everything I had, and funded a trip to Barbados because if you're going to start a new business, why not try Barbados? But I went there and I didn't have enough money to start this business. But I had 3 wonderful months in Barbados. Came back and realized I didn't really have to work again, and I didn't want to work again, and I liked working on projects of my own design. And I had this idea for a graphical world, a bit like Second Life, but what I called a cradle-to-grave world, which meant that this world would be available to schools. And the big principle behind it was, see, I've never talked to you about this.
So no.
Interesting. The big principle about it was, when you look at Second Life, you think, why are the graphics so bad? And then you play Assassin's Creed, and the graphics are awesome.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I get vertigo when he crawls up the side of that. You know, and I think, why can't we marry the two things together? So I had this idea of using a game engine to program a virtual world. But I didn't want it to be just a social place. So I thought, okay, if I make a virtual world that is as good graphically as you can get, then you could create a copy of, for instance, the Brazilian rainforest, that has accurate representations of the plants that are there. And you could have a school going on a school outing to the Brazilian rainforest virtually, with virtual reality. And you could potentially have 4 or 5 schools all across the world going. And the specialist on Brazilian rainforest in the world might be a professor in New York, and they log in New York and give a lesson to 100 kids from all over the world in a virtual Brazilian rainforest and say, all right, now come with us, and we go through this little area here. There's a clearing, and you can see there are cows there. This is the biggest danger to the forest, is people are deforesting to put cows in. And they could talk about that, discuss that, and see it actually there.
Yeah.
And then when the professor's finished, they can spend an hour walking around, and they could look at a plant and, you know, virtually touch it, and a little thing pops up and says, this plant is the Latin name whatever, it's known by the local people as this, it's used for this purpose in medicine, etc, etc, etc. And so I just thought it was a great opportunity to get kids into this virtual system, and then let it grow with them, or them grow with it. So when they start, sort of move on to say 12, it's there to take them to Paris. So they go to Paris and meet up with a French school that are also, let's say they could be from Marseille, and they all go to Paris together, and they're speaking French together and chatting. And then maybe they decide in the afternoon they're going to go to China and have a look around wherever, Shanghai. And so the idea was that this thing would grow with them as they grew older, and eventually when they left school, they could just use it then as a social thing. So, but I could do the programming. I could not do the graphics.
Yeah.
You know, it's a special skill and a long trained skill. Yeah. And as hard as I could, as hard as I tried, I just couldn't do it. And at some point, you've got to say, if I can't get the resources and I can't do it myself. So I spent 5 years on that. And the best decision I made was to give it up, which is hard after 5 years.
Yeah. We are, you know, so often we kind of don't give up or don't let things go just because of the sunken cost fallacy. Like, I put so much time and effort into it, I don't want all that to go to waste. But, you know, more often than not, we kind of need to just give up and move forward in life on the other things.
The other thing is, you know, it's an experience I wouldn't like to have missed.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'd rather look back and say, you know, I gave it a go. It's not one of those 100 ideas that I never tried.
You know? Yeah.
I can only say I gave it my best shot. It wasn't to be, and that's how it is.
Yeah. Well, what do you like doing in your free time? Other than programming, because I'm sure that's all you've been doing for a while.
I love music. I've always loved music. I can't play anything. and I blame that entirely on an old ex-girlfriend. Because she came to see me once and I'd been learning to play the guitar. And she was a concert standard cellist.
Oh, wow.
And she picked up my guitar, having never touched a guitar, and said, "What's your favorite piece of music?" And I played it to her once on a tape machine. It's called Romanza, and it was John Williams playing it. And I kid you not, she just went blah, blah, and did the whole song perfectly on a classical guitar. And I might well have uttered a few expletives, but I didn't pick up a guitar again after that. But I still love music.
Yeah.
So I love my music. I love movies. I'm a lifelong Liverpool supporter. And so this COVID thing, I don't know if you know, but we were 2 games off winning the Premier League for the first time in 30 years. And we just, I think this weekend we started. So they're 2 games off winning the Premier League. And,
but kind of like the momentum has been lost a little bit, it seems like.
It has, but yeah. I think they've, I mean, I don't know if you know, but they're owned by FSG, the Fenway Sports Group.
Okay.
So they actually, in a funny kind of way, have a similar story to the Boston, because we have a stadium that's renowned worldwide, Anfield, but it's in the middle of the city. And how do you expand it? And of course, they had the same problem Fenway did in Boston. And they looked at it and said, "We've got to keep it here. It's got too much history." And so they did a similar thing. And of course, they had the Curse of the Bambino with Boston. And you know, a lot of us are thinking that we were cursed 30 years without a win. And we used to win it all the time. It was boring how often we used to win it. So but yeah, I'm a mad Liverpool fan.
And then the virus comes along.
And we have a, you know, German manager, Jurgen Klopp. He's brilliant, an absolute scream. He's actually got me learning a bit of German. That's, just in case I ever meet him, I want to speak to him in his own language, because, you know, we dream of meeting each other. But he's the best manager we've had in a very long time. We've had some excellent managers.
Wonderful. Now, have you ever considered yourself to be a religious person? And do you have like a story to share about that?
Well, I went to Sunday school and I was in a church choir until nature interceded and decided that my voice wasn't going to be as high as it was at that time. And it was totally benign. I don't think I ever met the vicar or the reverend once. I always came away with it with bare memories of it. So I certainly was never indoctrinated. And you know, the Church of England is a very insipid kind of religion. You know, they don't want to annoy anybody. Is kind of, you know, their doctrine. And you know, if you said to them, well, you know, I think the resurrection of Christ is myth. They say, well, that's a very interesting thought. You know, that's probably how they would react. You know, they wouldn't say, oh, you can't say that. It's the grounding of our entire religion, you know, that they'd say, oh, well, yes, that's a good, you know, position. So, yeah, they're very insipid.
They're like the Canadians of religion. Is that kind of what you're...
Yeah. Well, they're almost, because, again, with the Europe thing, they're kind of, we would call them the Swiss, because they don't get involved in an argument, you know.
The Swiss religion.
Yeah. So, you know, Germany and Britain can be fighting all around them, but they won't get involved, you know. So they are a bit Swiss. it is the Church of England, so it is a state religion, and we do pay for it. But we have female vicars, we have married vicars. We are not, I'm sad to say, free of the seedier and nastier side of religion. There is still child abuse, which is probably one of the big reasons why I volunteered with RFR. I've always been very anti-bullying. Considering my size and height, I was bullied as a kid, and I came out of it very anti-bullying. And I feel less so the Church of England, but certainly when you look at the indoctrination of a lot of the other religions, it's bullying on a massive scale. And when they target children to get them on board, that's just, you know, beyond the pale. And that's why I got involved with RFR.
Okay. Bullying for you was kind of like this motivation. It's something that had stuck with you for a long time as a child, and then now you kind of see a way to fight against it in a sense through RFR, just for your own personal.
Yeah. The other thing is that when as a kid you face bullying, there's a point really where you can say, well, they know no better. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid religion doesn't have that excuse for me.
Yeah. You know,
these are adults targeting children for indoctrination in things they cannot prove. And that's just not right. That is bullying in my mind. And that's probably the main reason why I don't go. A friend of mine who I meet at the pub every now and again, we were talking the other day, and I know he's a very religious guy, and we've never discussed religion. And he said, very much in passing, of course, you know, I was regularly beaten up by the brothers at the school that I was at. And he was at a Church of England school that was run next to a monastery, and the brothers were the teachers. And he said, and this is how screwed up it made him. He said, he went to a reunion the other day that was not at the school, but it was held by the kids who had been there previously.
Sure.
And he said they were all talking about how they had been sexually abused by the
What?
And he said, I know this is going to sound strange, but my immediate thought was, why wasn't I?
He felt left out?
Yeah.
Wow.
Why were they special? Why, you know?
Oh, gosh.
That is screwed up.
That is screwed up. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow. Huh. Well, that, you know, like you were saying, this child abuse is rampant. I mean, we had a conversation with Sherry D'Souza, one of the faces of RFR, and that was one of the triggers for her coming out of Jehovah's Witness. Like, the final straw was when this report came out of the sheer number of abuse cases that were involved. And I know the Mormon Church is impacted by this, and the Catholic Church is notorious for it. And, I'm grateful that folks like you on the helpline and like Sherry and the support groups can provide some solace for folks who have gone that through that and direct them towards some resources that are helpful.
In a way, though, that highlights one of the hardest things that you have to do as a helpline volunteer, because you do immediately want to empathize.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I've never been sexually abused. And it would be incredibly wrong of me to say, oh, I know how you feel. I was bullied. Because I don't know how they feel. And this is one of the key tenets of how we operate as a helpline. You find out about them. Find out what they think, what's hurting them, and you don't impose any of yourself on it. And that's why we try and keep this, if you pardon the pun, wall of separation in a way, between us.
Yeah.
And it's because we have to be in a position to get them to come forward and talk and get them to say it all, and not potentially stop them from talking by saying, oh yes, I've felt this, that, and that. It's always got to be related to them.
Yeah. You know, and that's tough for some folks to do that, and not every volunteer is the right fit for the helpline. Because it does take a lot of that discipline to not talk about yourself and to be there for somebody else. So how would you describe your current beliefs?
It shouldn't be this hard, should it?
You want to pass?
Not really, no. I'm an atheist, but it's this agnostic atheist that worries me. Because do I actually think that there's a God as portrayed in the Bible? No, I can't believe that. That is a fairy story too far for me. But there is one doubt in my head, and that is, why nature works the way it does. Because I'm more than happy to understand, for instance, how the water cycle works. But why do water molecules attract? Because if they didn't attract, the water cycle wouldn't work. Plants couldn't siphon water out of the ground with their roots up into the leaves. Trees wouldn't work. If they didn't work, life doesn't work. So why do water molecules attract? I don't know that. And I've never heard anybody tell me why that happened. And even if they did, how did it come about that they came about? You know, it's so amazing is nature. And maybe these are answers we'll never get. And that's the one slightest thing that says, I don't know that there isn't something, a power of some kind, that was able to say, right, what we need is we need this molecule to do that, we need that molecule to do that, we need that to do that, and put it all together. I don't know. And the fact that it does it is kind of awe-inspiring.
Yeah. Yeah, I find wonder in the natural world as well. When I came out of my spiritual thinking and mindset, the world and the universe increased in wonder for me, several orders of magnitudes, and the improbability of things happening and occurring, sort of like what you're talking about, and with some of these physical laws that were set somehow, just made it even more wondrous.
Have you seen that video? And there's a scientist who does a video where he gets some pure chemicals and just drops them into a petri dish. And he said, this is a chemical that will search for food. And it's one chemical. Mm-hmm. And he just drops it in there. And he said, no, it's out there doing nothing. And I'll put some food in on the other side of the petri dish. And he put some food in. And the thing starts buzzing around and goes and finds the food. Oh. I mean, hey, well done for finding that out, but how? And then he puts another one in and says, this one likes to find other things very similar to itself. And so he puts loads of dots of that in. And it goes into one big lump one. And then he says, no, this is one that it likes to get together. And then when it reaches a certain size, it likes to split them apart and create copies of itself. And he goes and puts in, boom, woof, and it starts splitting itself. And you're thinking, that's life, man. Yeah, just crazy. Crazy. Yeah. With just, you know, four chemicals. It's, I don't know, really amazing.
So we talked a little bit about what you see for the future in your volunteering for Recovering from Religion. And I think we might have maybe touched on it a little bit, but what keeps you going? What would keep you going with your volunteering?
Well, the funny thing is, when I started, the doing the chats and the calls was important. But you don't have a career in IT and go into volunteering and think, I'm not going to use this IT. You know, it's going to come poor. So it would also, to be honest, be remiss of me to not make my experience and skills available to RFR from an IT perspective. So I can see me playing, you know, a continuous role in IT. And I'd like to think that we can move more with the times. The idea of RFR 3.0 is that it prepares us for the future a bit more. It's allows us expansion. But it's not going to do that possibly beyond another 10 years. And so if I'm still around, I'd like to be part of RFR 4. But even if that doesn't happen and I spend the next 10 years doing occasional tech support, just doing the chat is something that I really enjoy. I'd love to think that at some stage we could improve on the resources. I don't wish that to sound negative about them, but we've got some wonderful talent within RFR, especially at creating videos. And I would love us to almost have a kind of video on demand resources section. So rather than having podcasts or video blogs, it's more that you're searching through a video on demand library. So you can just say, right, I want to know more about weddings for Jehovah's Witnesses. Click, up pops the video.
Are you like envisioning it being more educational? Is that kind of, because that's kind of how I would see, like, if I was searching for a wedding for Jehovah's Witness type knowledge, just from where I'm at, that, you know, that would be interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think in a way, that's the role of resources to our client. Yeah,
that's true.
It is education. And it's, you know, one of the things that we see is how amazing religion is at telling you they are educating you while keeping so much away from it.
Yeah.
And that people come out of religion with massive gaps of knowledge. And so if we can provide that resource in a really, you know, 20-minute section, 20-minute video on this, that, you know, I think that could be good. I think a lot of people, more and more these days, don't like to read a 2-page PDF or something.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
They'd rather have somebody say, you know, this is available on PDF, but if you just want the cliff notes, this is how we do it. So.
You can have like the PDF and the video together on the same page.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I have got one final question for you, because this has been a really fun and fantastic interview. But I've got one final question. And if you could travel back in time and talk to your past self, who would you talk to and what would you talk about? I know we talked like earlier about this and you're like, I don't know what I'm going to do.
I've got to keep it clean. I would actually go back to my 13-year-old self, because at that time I moved from a state school to a private school, and I went from being a big fish in a small pond to being a small fish in a big pond, and everybody there was far better educated than I was. And I would say to that 13-year-old, don't worry about it. It's not as bad as you actually think it is. You'll get on fine. Put a lot more effort into your sport. Enjoy being a heterosexual male. And don't give up the football. Because I gave up the football, you know, and because I found out how wonderful it was to spend time with nubile women. And the problem was, when the nubile woman said, I've had enough, and goes, I can't go back and play football straight away. I've got to get fit again.
Oh, yeah.
And this is exactly what happened. You know, I gave up sport for 3 years. She found somebody else. I've got no problem with it. And I went and played cricket and blew my knee.
Mm.
So.
Well, that's cricket for you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, vicious sport.
Well, Chris, again, thank you so much for sitting down and talking with us. I really appreciate learning about you and kind of getting to know you and some of your motivations for joining Recovering from Religion and what keeps you around. So this was fantastic, man.
Well, it's been my pleasure. You know, I've known you for a little while now, and one of the things that people don't understand when they first start volunteering for RFR, and what you can't put on the website, is you will make friends. You will start. There's a huge camaraderie here, and I feel I've made friends that are friends for life.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. I'm right there with you. This is we all kind of have a similar mindset, and we all have this kind of giving and caring and empathetic type of outlook on what we do.
And a desire for us all to succeed. You know, we want everybody else to do really well.
Yes. Yeah.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.